From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the pioneering blogger Heather Armstrong talks about the 10 times her doctors made her brain dead. It was a clinical trial to flatline the brain as a treatment for severe depression, which she's dealt with all her life. Armstrong tells the story in a new book. The procedure was safe but risky, and the only thing she really worried about was that she would never stop feeling like she wanted to be dead. We'll be right back.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those who follow the various versions of her blog, it seems Heather Armstrong didn't keep a whole lot to herself. Hers was one of the first, probably the most popular mommy blogs. It was ruthlessly honest and profane at times and touching and funny, where she talked about what it was really like to be a parent and raise kids. Heather was honest and funny about her family, unpolished, conservative Mormons in Tennessee, and how she became the black sheep when she eventually left the church and became a liberal. And she was honest and funny about her struggles with depression. But one thing was hard to convey was just how bad it had gotten by 2017, a particularly bad bout that had lasted a year and a half by then. In a new memoir, she writes about how she would go into her closet to hide from her kids, and she would call her mom. Sometimes she would just scream. Sometimes after her mom said hello, she would just utter without any emotion, "I don't want to be alive anymore." The book is about her experience with a series of experimental procedures to basically flatline her brain as a treatment for this kind of severe depression. The book is called The Valedictorian of Being Dead, The True Story of Dying 10 Times to Live. Heather Armstrong lives in Salt Lake City, but she's on tour. She joined us from NPR in New York. She's giving a talk this weekend at the King's English. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. There's the story you tell early in the book when you went to see your psychiatrist and basically, you just wanted to refill your medication, but you couldn't do it over the phone. He had to see you. And so there's this moment when you actually do see him, like you're sitting in front of him, and he like immediately could see how deeply depressed you were. In fact, he said it was written on your face. He said this. He said it has, which was kind of beautiful the way he put this, I have to say, it has stolen your eyes. I wanted to start there. What was it that he was seeing?
I desperately did not want to see him and had avoided seeing him for a very long time because medical professionals are required by law, by their oath, to do certain things when they think that people are on the edge of something, right?
Yeah.
And I desperately did not want to see him because I knew that he would know by looking at me. And I remember sitting across from him and he just looked at me and I looked at him and he said, you know, you don't have to say anything. You don't have to say a word. I know exactly what is going on. And I just looked down at my hands because I was like, what is he going to do?
Yeah.
And he... I think he was both really, really angry at me and also really giddy at the fact that I was there at a time when he could recommend me for the study.
Yeah. Is it possible, do you think, to describe what you were going through, what this was like? I mean, in the book, you talk about this conversation you had with your daughter. And I liked how you put it. You said that it was like your brain got caught in the middle of the ocean and you didn't have a raft. You didn't have, you know, a life jacket or anything like that. All you could do was tread water. But then you started to get really, really tired, and you started to sink. Does that sort of get at what was going on?
Yeah. It was a depression that I thought would get better after certain factors had ended. I had agreed to run a marathon for a runner who was visually impaired, and I was eating a very strict vegan diet, and I thought, okay, well, I'm tired, and the training has taken everything out of me, and once I get out of the marathon, I'm going to feel better, when in fact, everything sort of collapsed in on itself when the marathon ended, and I had no reason anymore to point to say, okay, well, this is why I feel bad. And I started to sink further and further and further, to the point that I realized, okay, well, I'm just always going to want to be dead.
Yeah.
I'm just going to live with that sensation, and I'm resigned to it. That's what it felt like.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I mean, you wanted to be dead, but for you, that never meant suicide. I mean, you say during the time you were in this hole, you never came close to hurting yourself. You say you had never really tried to take your own life. So just explain to me the difference, because I think that's interesting.
So the difference is, I have two beautiful, beautiful, beautiful girls, and they were my responsibility. They are my meaning in life, and I knew that I had to be there for their every need. And you know, I honor them for giving me the reason to hold on. Mm. I don't know what I was holding on to, other than the fact that I just needed to be there to take care of them. Suicide just wasn't an option.
Yeah.
As a mother of two children, it's just, I mean, I can't do that to them. But feeling that sad is, I couldn't help feeling that sad. I couldn't help the feeling that it would be amazing to not have any sensation.
Yeah.
And I think that is the sort of difference, is that as much as I wouldn't kill myself, not wanting to feel as sad as I was the overpowering feeling going on.
You write about thinking of the idea of a suicide note, though, like why people write these notes, and why do you figure they do? Because I thought your reflection on this was interesting.
It's really interesting that you focused on that. You know, when I sat down to write the book, I didn't know that I was going to write that chapter about suicide notes. It came out of me spontaneously, out of nowhere, because I didn't understand the idea of a suicide note. And I think I explain it a little bit in the book, in the sense that I don't know how anybody outside of the brain of a suicidal ideation can understand just how much we think we are taking up your space, and that we don't belong here, and that we are making your life worse, and that is the true reason that we would go to that extreme. And so many people jump to the conclusion that it's a very selfish act, when I think most people who get to that point are so desperate to relieve the people in their lives of their presence. And how do you communicate that in a note? I don't know.
Well, you wonder in the book, maybe they just want a, this is how you put it, a goodbye to be spoken. Like, it's just
a goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah. They want a finality to it. They want, you know, they want to grasp a firm reason for why this happened. Yeah. And that firm reason lives inside of that diseased and disabled and misled brain.
So you go to see your psychiatrist, and like you said, he's mad at you on one hand because you're not following through any of these treatments. But on the other hand, as you say, he's kind of giddy because he has this thing for you. There's this idea. He wanted you to consider this experimental study. So explain it. What's the idea as he presents it to you?
He really was giddy.
Yeah.
I have to tell you. He really was really angry at me. And don't you know, Heather, that the longer a depressive episode goes on, the harder it is to climb out of. And I can't believe that you have waited this long. Have I not told you this again and again and again? Right. And then he said, but I saw this glimmer in his eye.
Yeah.
And he ran over to the phone and he called his colleague and asked, is there room? Is there room for another person? Are you ready to do it? And he came back to me and I said, I want you to consider this. We are, there's a colleague of mine who has designed a study to replicate the effects of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, without the side effects, which are migraines and permanent memory loss and short-term memory loss. And they have designed the study to use an anesthesia to replicate what ECT does to the brain. And honestly, when I was sitting there and he said, I want you to consider something, I thought he was going to tell me that he wanted me to do ECT and I was going to run out of the room. I was like, if he says that, I'm running out of the room.
Yeah, yeah.
It has a bad reputation.
Yeah, yeah. But this, as he explains it to you, is different. I mean, they put you to sleep, but let's be honest, it's more than putting you to sleep. It practically makes you brain dead. It's a super intense, induced coma, basically.
Yes, it is a severely induced coma. And there's a passage in my book where my brother watches a treatment and... the anesthesiologist took my brother over to the monitor, which shows how much anesthesia they're giving me and my brain activity. And he says, see where your sister's brain is now at 40. So this is where we can cut a body open with anesthesia. This is where people can't feel anything. And he said, we're taking your sister all the way down to nothing. And the state is called burst suppression, where the brain exhibits no activity and then it has a burst, a tiny little burst of activity, and then no activity and then a tiny burst. And they determined through their research that 15 minutes of this was the optimal time to do it.
Do they know how it works or why it works, really?
I think if you talk to my psychiatrist and you talk to Dr. Brian Mickey, who did the study, and to Dr. Scott Tadler, who was the anesthesiologist, the idea is that during ECT, the brain is shocked into a seizure. If done right, the seizure causes the brain to go into a burst suppression state for a couple of minutes, which is flatlining with a burst, flatlining with a burst, flatlining with a burst. And they were like, well, if we could recreate that with anesthesia, then we could eliminate the memory loss. We could eliminate the migraines. We could eliminate all those things associated with ECT that make ECT stigmatized.
It's like rebooting your computer, you say, sort
yes,
of. And so each
exactly.
time each time you reboot, the idea is you get better, basically.
Have you tried turning it on and off again?
Right. Yeah.
Yes. A few times. It's like rebooting your computer 3 or 4 or 5 times to make sure that all of the systems and the circuitry has gone back to where it needs to be.
Yeah.
And in order to replicate ECT, so ECT patients go through, 10 to 15 treatments. So the study, you had to agree to 10 treatments. And so that's what I did.
Yeah. Explain why you were a perfect candidate. Because one of the things that made you qualified for this is that you had gotten to this point where they call it treatment-resistant depression. Like, things just were not, nothing was working to really deal with your depression.
I mean, I had changed my medication about 9 months previously, and I didn't feel better. I trained for a marathon, and I ate a vegan diet, and I was doing everything right to feel better. I have a lifelong history of depression.
Yeah.
I have a history of depression in my entire family, and that in itself. And I'm a healthy young relatively. And I, considering like my blood pressure and all of that, made me sort of like the perfect physical candidate for something like this to be tested on.
You tell the story in the book, and it's pretty straightforward as stories go. I mean, right after you heard about this treatment, you have to do this errand at the grocery store, pick up a balloon for your daughter's party, and you start joking around with a clerk there. Which is, like, doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but this was a big deal for you. And I wanted you to talk about that moment, because you talk about how for the first time, really in a long time, more than a year, you had this sense of what? Of hope, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I talk a lot about my family and my family history in this book. And I have inherited an ability to joke around with strangers, and especially at the grocery store for some reason. Yeah. My father emphasized to me, you know, making eye contact and making friends with people who serve you, and joking around and making them smile and bringing like a delight to their day. And I had lost that in my depression. I didn't want to interact with anyone. I didn't want to make eye contact with anyone, because it would require me to exhibit any emotion, which I didn't want anybody to see. And I remember driving to the grocery store after he told me about the possibility of this treatment, and I bought these balloons from this woman, and I just instinctively started joking around with her like my dad would. And it was shocking to me afterward when I realized I had done it, because it hadn't happened in so long and it came so naturally to me. And it was like, wait a minute, that must be because I feel hope in the possibility of feeling better.
Yeah. And this gets us to your relationship with your mom, because you contacted her and told her about this, and your mom felt it too when you called her later that day. She felt that sense of hope as well, I guess.
Yeah, she did. It was probably the first time I had called her in 18 months without screaming.
Yeah.
She felt the hope in my voice, and I wasn't screaming at her that I wanted to be dead. I was saying, Mom, there's this possibly crazy thing that could make me feel better, possibly. Mm. And I remember walking around the room as I told her about it. And I could feel her energy on the other end of the line of thinking, oh, yeah, this is the answer to my prayers.
Heather Armstrong. Her new book is called The Valedictorian of Being Dead. On Saturday night at 7 o'clock, she's giving a talk at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. She'll be joined by University of Utah Hospital doctor Scott Tadler. He was the lead anesthesiologist who treated her. You can get more details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the blogger Heather Armstrong about the 10 times her doctors made her brain dead, basically. It was a clinical trial to flatline her brain as a treatment for severe depression, which she's dealt with all her life. Armstrong tells the story in a new book about dying 10 times in order to live. It's called The Valedictorian of Being Dead. For those who don't know, you grew up Mormon, grew up in the South, grew up in Tennessee. You and your siblings came to Utah. Your mom followed. And you left Mormonism. And you describe in the book how you came to be seen as the black sheep. Not only left Mormonism, but you became a Democrat. you were seen as the crazy one in the family, is how you put it. The f*** up, as you say. Explain this. Like, where do you fit in the family? How are you seen now? Like, where do you situate yourself in that? Because this relationship with Mormonism isn't the only thing we need to talk about, but I do think it's somewhat interesting, at least in terms of the expectations that you had and how that may have contributed to the way you were thinking and feeling.
Yeah, I grew up the youngest of three kids in the South. And for those who know the vernacular, I grew up in the mission field. And when you grow up in the mission field, Mormonism is your identity. And you know everything about the religion, and the religion is who you are. And I wanted to be the perfect Mormon, and I had perfect attendance at early morning seminary, and I was the president of the Laurel, part of the Young Women's Program.
Right.
And I grew up being the best Mormon possible. And then something sort of snapped in me at the end of my tenure at BYU, and I left the church, and I'm the only one in my family who has not only left the church, but has registered Democrat and votes for very progressive policies in politics. And I think there is this, there's a tension between me and my family in that sense. I mean, we joke about it a bit, but then we don't joke about it a bit.
Yeah.
And I felt like, of course, I'm the crazy one. I'm the one who left the church. I'm the one who abandoned all those principles, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
I would be the one, of course, to have to go through some crazy treatment because I'm the one who has doubted the religion.
Yeah. So it turns out, of the patients in the study at that point, you went down and stayed down far better than anyone else, which gets us to the title, right?
The title of the book,
yes. The Valedictorian of Being Dead. You were the best. But it seems to reflect something larger about this pressure you felt and or put on yourself anyway to be the best or be perfect, as you said. So I wanted to know, as you look back on it, do you think in some way your depression, was your depression fueling your sense of having to be perfect? Or were the expectations you felt from your faith and your family, was that fueling your depression? Or was it a little bit of all of that?
I'm sure it was all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, so to explain the title, this is an experimental study, and I was the third to go through it.
Yeah.
And when they administered the propofol to me for the first time, I went down so fast that they had to struggle to get the breathing tube in fast enough. And my mother watched as they struggled with my limp body.
Yeah.
And you know, the doctor turned to her and explained, "We've never seen no patient has gone down as fast as she did. No patient has gone down to this point where we had to do this sort of struggle." And my mom said, well, she's the best at everything she does. So, of course, I went down fast. I have, through my life and through no prodding of my parents, I wanted to make my mother happy, and I thought that being perfect and being the valedictorian of everything was going to make my mom happy. That was like my purpose in life. And so the valedictorian, like I was a valedictorian in high school. I went to BYU on scholarship. Doing things perfectly, I thought, was going to bring her happiness. Mm-hmm. And me being imperfect as a mother and being so sad, I think that absolutely contributed to my depression because I wasn't living up to being the mom I was supposed to be.
Yeah. I wonder, you've had to think about this from time to time. I mean, certainly in the blog you had written about your family and, like, what do I reveal about their lives? What do I reveal about my life? How far should I go? And I'm wondering how you were thinking about it this time as you were writing the book and what you say about, like, your father, which we'll get to. I mean, you reveal some really difficult things about your father and his reaction to one particular treatment, which is really interesting. But how are you thinking about what you should say and what you should reveal? I mean, I know you've worked through this before, but was this experience writing this book any different in terms of the way you were thinking about that?
Writing this book was a completely different experience from anything that I've ever done in my career. I sat down and wrote this from cover to cover, and I had to, in order to explain where I had gotten, in order to explain what I was feeling and how far down I had sunk, I had to talk about some very painful things from my past. And otherwise, it wouldn't make sense. And I think I probably reveal more in this book than I've ever revealed on my website, which is saying a lot. And even if you read this book, you would say, well, no way. Like, Heather's way more, way, way, way more crass on her website and way more revealing. Except that I revealed, you know, aspects of my childhood and my divorce that have never been discussed before, but had to be discussed in order to explain why my brain got where it got. And I consulted with my mother quite a bit about these details, and she agreed that we needed to let them into the light.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about, so the first time you go through this procedure and the feeling you were feeling, it's interesting you say in the book that you were, of course, anxious and kind of scared, but you say that you weren't afraid you were going to die in the gurney. You weren't afraid they weren't going to be able to take you out of anesthesia. You said you were terrified I would never stop feeling this way and that you couldn't remember what it was like not to feel that way. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, people ask me, like, how could you possibly have agreed to do something like this? And I don't think that they understand the desperation of what a brain that tells you that you are a waste of space and you live with that constantly. I am a waste of space. I am performing duties for my children, except that someone else could perform them better. Mm. And sorry, it's hard to talk about.
Take your time.
Go ahead.
Take your time, Heather. You can, we can move on.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about, there was this moment where you, your daughter, it's kind of funny, actually, because you had left Mormonism. you and her father made no bones about the fact that you didn't believe in not only organized religion, but God. And she knows this. Both of your daughters knew this. And you're talking to her, and she has this kind of confession. And this is while you're going through all of this. And she confesses that she believes in God.
Yeah.
And not only that, she confesses that she sometimes prays. And she's worried what you're going to make of that. Like, you're going to be mad about that. I just wanted you to talk about that story, if you would, and what you make of it. Because I think it's, I don't know, it says something about this idea of faith and where it might fit in your story or anyone else's.
Yeah, isn't it interesting how faith weaves itself into my story?
Yeah.
So ironic. I have always, I approached my daughter very early on, and I told her that I wanted her to be able to talk to me about anything. If she came across anything online, I mean, we have to have these discussions with our kids. If she came across anything online that was inappropriate or made her feel weird or made her feel something that she didn't feel was appropriate, or if she was concerned about something in her life, I wanted her to be able to come and talk to me about it. And I promised her that if she said, "Mom, I need to talk to you about something," that I would never get mad at her. Mm. And I was like, "I want you to be safe talking to me about anything." And she had come to me a couple of times about things she'd run across on YouTube, and we cleared those things up. But there was one night, and I used to read next to her at night, and she was like, "I don't want to read tonight. I want to talk to you about something very serious, and I need to tell you something." And I got really, really worried. And I'm like, "Oh my, what has she come across? What did she Google? What happened at school?" I just was like, all this stuff was like running through my head. And we sit down, and she takes this gigantic breath, and she says, "You promise you won't be mad at me?" And I was like, "I promise." And she like blurted out, "I believe in God." And I looked at her, and I'm like, "What?" And she's like, "I believe in God." And I said, "Oh, okay." And she's like, are you mad at me?" And I said, "No, of course I'm not mad at you." She's like, "Really? I know that you don't believe in God." And I said, I said, "Lita, you know, I want that to be your choice. Like, the only reason that I was mad about it is that I feel like I wasn't given a choice. Like, you have every choice. Yeah. If you want to believe in God, you can absolutely." And she's like, "Well, sometimes I pray." And then I offered, I said, "You know, I used to be like, you know, an Olympian prayer."
Yeah. I can help you.
"I'll even pray with you."
Yeah.
"I can pray with you." Yeah. She said it brings her comfort. And so I reveled in the fact that she was comfortable enough to tell me that and to feel safe in that, and that she made that decision on her own.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to give her.
Interesting that she used the kind of Mormon architecture of a prayer, like ended in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. And all,
yes.
Which is, I'm sure she's heard plenty of that in the family as you go to these different things where you're supporting others in the faith. But I did wonder, was there any remnant of your own Mormonism, you know, kind of relics of your Mormon experience that did provide you comfort or perspective or even some kind of routine when you were going through all of this?
You know, I mourn for my kids, the lack of knowing hymns and like primary songs. I can hear a certain note or a certain chord, and I can be completely transported back to the Ward House in Memphis, Tennessee, singing along with my mother and sitting there eating certs out of her purse and listening to the bishop. And those are precious memories of mine that my children don't have. And I absolutely do think that the musicality of my religion has saved me. time and time and time and time again. And I mourn that my kids don't have that.
Let's talk about St. Patrick's Day, 2017. This is your fifth treatment. You were four in. How did you feel it was going at that point?
I was four in, and sometimes when depressed people start to feel better, we don't know. Just because we don't really identify. We're not like, I am sad. We are just experiencing sadness.
Yeah.
And so when we start to feel better, it's not like, oh, I feel better. It's just that it's just something that we're experiencing. My mother pointed out after the second and third treatment that that I had started showering.
Yeah.
I had started putting on clean clothes. And I didn't even realize I was doing it. I didn't realize I was putting on extra makeup and making sure my clothes were clean. And I mean, I was up to the fourth treatment. I was really frustrated because I thought I was wasting everyone's time. It was a lot of time. They had to sacrifice hours and hours and hours of their life to drive me there and stay there and then take me home and help out my kids as I recovered from the anesthesia. And I was like, I'm wasting their time. And then the fifth treatment happened. And it was the first time that I came home and didn't need to recover.
Yeah.
I felt energized and strangely, like, strangely, almost like a kangaroo, like I wanted to jump around. And I turned to them and said, yeah, you guys don't need to stay. I'm fine. Like, I'm going to be good tonight. It was a sudden turnaround.
I think anyone who follows your work knows how important music is to you. And there's this great story you tell on this day of hearing a song from the British band Adorable, the song Homeboy. I wanted you to tell this story because, I don't know, it just seemed remarkable. You say in the book that it was like hearing music for the first time.
Yeah. So this band put out either one or two albums, and the label, I think, discontinued the album, and you can't get it anywhere except like on eBay. Like, it's not on Spotify. It's not on Apple. It's not on any of the services. You can barely find it anywhere. And it was an album that I listened to. It was a tape. It was a cassette tape that I listened to throughout college. And those songs were the soundtrack to me falling in love with Utah.
Yeah.
Even though I was falling out of the religion, I was falling in love with Utah, which for me is a very strange dichotomy because Utah is so Mormon. And Adorable, the band, was sort of representative of that duality. And I remember going over to this person's house, this guy that I had met on Match.com, which is another part of my depression, was trying to date in Utah. And he had the album. He had the actual vinyl, and he put it on the record player. And I was like, can you play Homeboy? And he placed it directly on that little curve in the vinyl. And I can't describe. I try to describe what happened because I hadn't heard that song in 25 years. And it really was like opening the door and seeing color for the first time. And I remember just sobbing tears of like uncontrollable tears of happiness because it was like music was just like it was screaming inside of my body. And I felt happy.
Do you think you understand like what happened? Like what did that treatment do that made you hear that song differently or for the first time? Like, was something broken loose or was something uncovered by that treatment? Do you think you understand what had happened?
Well, You know, I've talked quite a bit with the lead anesthesiologist on the study, and what they're trying to figure out is how to basically the circuits in the brain, how do we mend them? How do we rewire them? How do we make them work again? Mm-hmm. How do we cure the ones that have become ill? And just like rebooting a computer, I think that after the fifth treatment, something had happened inside my brain where the connections started working again. And I could hear, and I could see, and I could smell, and I could taste in a different way than I had the day before, completely differently. It was such a stark contrast that I have to tell people about this. This has to be known. This has to be a wider available, you know, process to people.
So I want to ask you about treatment number 7, where you weren't sure you wanted to let your father and your stepmother know about what was going on. And you had this conversation with your mother, and she felt like he should. And so he was there for this 7th treatment. This is really one of the tough parts of the book, I have to say, because your mother is going through this anguish, and your father, whom you love and revere and make that clear in the book, but he has a very different kind of reaction. I mean, he and your stepmother were kind of skeptical about all of this. How dangerous is it? And probably skeptical about just how deep the depression may have actually been. Anyway, he sat there, as your mother told you later, and just watched as you went into this treatment. Didn't say a word. Later you go into the parking lot. He doesn't really say anything to you about it. He just basically says, as you're driving away, to your stepfather, you know, drive carefully. And then he goes away. What do you make of that reaction?
Well, my mother watched 10 times as I went under. She watched, I mean, and every single time they had to rush and put the breathing tube in my body. Every single time. Mm-hmm. And my mother really considered, again, she's very religious, and I honor that part about her. She really considered it a sacred space for us to be in that room together, going through this experience together. Mm-hmm. And she had invited my father into it. And I'm not exactly sure where my father thinks that depression begins and the will to step up and own yourself meet.
Yeah.
She did remind me that he sat next to me in the recovery room, and he rubbed my forehead until I woke up. I don't think that my father knew what to do. Mm-hmm. And I gave my father a copy of the book earlier this week, and I gave him a letter. And in that letter, I told him how much I loved him and how much I needed him to understand that I didn't want to lay blame anywhere. I just needed people to understand why my brain had taken certain pathways, and that I loved him and cherished the time that I have left with him.
But I think the thing that your mother sort of got from that moment was, and this is how you put it in the book, you write, now we know for sure we wouldn't talk to them, that is your father and your stepmother, about our own struggles, and especially not about the struggles of our children. None of us should have to deal with someone questioning whether or not suffering was real.
Right.
So you invited him into the sacred space and then kind of regretted it. Like, it wasn't really the place for him. Is that unfair?
I think I don't think that was the place for him. I think my father wants to help.
Yeah.
He just doesn't know how. And actually, something interesting has happened in the last few months with my father. Like, there is a place for my father in my life. And he's the only person in my life who's had a blended family. Mm-hmm. And I remember calling my mom and talking about, I have just recently blended families. And I called my mother to talk about some of the conflict going on. And she said, you need to call your father.
Yeah.
And I was like, you want me to call my dad? And she's like, call your dad. And I called him and I was like, hey, I need to run some stuff by you. And he was so excited to help me.
Yeah.
I had given him an avenue to help me. And since then, he and I talk probably once or twice a week, and he texts me, and we have developed a relationship because I have given him an opportunity to help me.
Wow.
I've given him like a way to come into my life.
So on that last treatment, number 10, going in there with your mom and your stepfather, you describe it as having a kind of solemnity to it, this moment. And you say you were experiencing, which I found this was so interesting, a kind of a shared melancholy is how you put it. What was that about, the sense of melancholy as you went into this final treatment?
Like I said, my mother will describe it as one of the most sacred experiences of her life, going through this.
Yeah.
And you know, my older child goes to a 6-week camp during the summer in New York. And she's so sad when it's over because she has to say goodbye to all the memories and the shared experiences. And my mother and my stepfather and I made that drive 10 times. And they came with me 10 times. And they watched me 10 times. And I woke up 10 times and drove home 10 times. And it was this very sacred and solemn experience that the three of us will always carry very, very, very deep in our souls. And we knew during that last treatment that it was over. Hmm. And that I had gotten better.
Yeah. You say in the book, you're no longer in the abyss, of course. Your life is chaotic still. Of course, you're still a single mom. But you're handling it. How do you describe where you are right now? Certainly not cured. That's not the right way to put it, right?
No. You don't ever really cure depression.
Yeah.
You, like, I'm heavily, heavily medicated. Heavily medicated. I take, you know, they emphasize at the end of the treatment that you have to stay on your medication. And I take my medication religiously. And life is chaotic. I have a 9-year-old and a 15-year-old who have two completely separate schedules. And there's a lot of driving and there's a lot of anger and frustration and, you know, tears and life. Life is messy. Everybody's life is messy. But I no longer wake up thinking, oh God, well, how am I going to do this? I wake up and I'm like, here we go. Here we go. I'm happy to tackle what has to happen during the day because I'm alive to watch them be the unique and wonderful. You know, my younger kid wears a llama hat everywhere she goes. And all of my publicity for my book, she appears in a hat that looks like a llama. And I'm so happy to be alive to appreciate and laugh about that. I can't express enough gratitude to the people at that clinic who gave me back my life.
Let me ask you one more thing. So you're part of this. It was a controlled scientific study. Just tell us finally what comes of it. I mean, there's a report now published in a peer-reviewed journal, and it seems like, even though Dr. Mickey, you mentioned, he's a scientist, so he's really restrained. He's like, hold on, don't get too excited. But he's got to be really excited about the possibilities of all of this.
Yeah, well, he is really, really shy and very, 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 you know, conservative in how he talks about things. And I interviewed him like just to get some, as I was doing some of the more scientific language in the book. And he said, you know, we just came up with this study after like looking at a few different others. And we had 10 of you and 6 of you experienced good results. Like, that's kind of like unheard of. Yeah. And he was like, but, you know, I have to be very conservative about, you know, the results. But they're now conducting the double blind study part of the study. And it's gone into its next phase. And there's so much promise with this. And I believe in it. And I knew that writing a blog post or, you know, doing a one-off piece in a magazine was not going to be enough for them to get the attention that they needed. And so I asked Dr. Mickey if I could write about this experience because I wanted them to get as much attention as possible so that they could continue with this research.
Heather Armstrong, she writes the blog deuce.com, and her new book is The Valedictorian of Being Dead, The True Story of Dying 10 Times to Live. On Saturday night at 7, she's giving a talk at the King's English Bookshop. She'll be joined by the lead anesthesiologist from her treatment team. You can get information about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.